Penguin Random House Audio presents Who Can Hold the Sea? The U.S. Navy in the Cold War, 1945 through 1960, by James D. Hornfisher. Read for you by Christopher Newton. Preface and Acknowledgements read by Sharon Hornfisher. To all the U.S. men and women who have served in uniform for a better Afghanistan since September 11, 2001. Your valor matters. Whoever can hold the sea has command of everything. Themistocles, Athenian navalist, 524 through 460 BC.
Preface. This is a book about the Navy, but it's also about foreign affairs. It's about presidencies, war, and peace, America in the world, politics and policy, morals and war, about innovation, atomic weapons and propulsion, computerization, and guided missiles. This is a long book. To paraphrase Ben Franklin, this book twice as easily could have been three times its length, even though it covers just about half of its ultimate subject. In this book, too, the span of time, the range of events, the surge of ideas, the flow of money, the spectrum of characters are many. Naval history can encompass the full variety of technical programs in naval aviation, submarine and amphibious warfare, surface ship tactics, intelligence, command, administration, shipbuilding, basing, and operational stories from the four corners of the world. Jim's ambition has been to sample all these fascinating morsels while focusing on the main dish, the worldwide geopolitical rivalry between the U.S. Navy and the Soviet Union. Research, thoroughgoing, comprehensive, and hopelessly incomplete. The merest glance at the finding aids of NARA, National Archives and Records Administration, or NHHC, Naval History and Heritage Command, suggests the depths of data that await a writer looking into naval history. That history will need to be told by another on another day. This book is also about humanity and the fragility of it. You know James D. Hornfisher as a passionate author of books of our nation's war in the Pacific, and with this book, the Cold War. Jim wrote about the wars fought by our neighbors, brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles, fathers and grandfathers. For the past 2 years, Jim has been fighting his own war. I don't want to dwell on this, nor would Jim want me to, but I believe his readers would want and deserve to know of Jim's courage. In the early days of 2020, just months before the pandemic hit our shores, Jim was diagnosed with an inoperable glioblastoma brain tumor. Jim wanted to live each day as fully as possible, and I wanted to honor him by following that lead. He didn't keep his diagnosis a secret, but he didn't talk about it much either. Jim fought very bravely for 18 months in every area of his life and was largely pain-free throughout his illness and the cancer's progression. For that, I am intensely grateful. Jim passed away peacefully here at home in Austin, Texas, surrounded by family, friends, our Springer Spaniels, Sullivan and Skye, and his books, having converted his library into a first-floor bedroom. Jim's illness was progressive, and there were periods where he could not be as productive as he would have liked, but he continued to write and work every day until he was no longer able. This book is his last published work, and as his illness progressed, his writing told that story within a story. Please regard this text as a last letter from an old friend, and please understand that your friend was simply not able to wrap up the story with his usual finesse and depth of detail. Jim believed, as I also do, that others of this generation and future generations will carry on telling the stories of our great nation's history. Share your stories with your children and grandchildren, nieces and nephews, so that they are engaged in our nation's history and our country's continued fight for freedom and democracy. Encourage our next generation. Take them to air shows, museums, and libraries. Ignite the spark of curiosity in our future historians and writers so that they can continue to tell stories for us all to read.
Introduction. The story of the U.S. Navy's Cold War is no tidy war story, or even a campaign narrative. Chronicling the twists and turns of the tumultuous early years of the Cold War at sea, looking at the flow of global events of the U.S.-Soviet and capitalist-communist rivalries through the lens of maritime power, is the mission of this book. Readers acquainted with my earlier books will find this one much broader in scope. I offer it knowing that it's prone to fall short here and there. Those interested in submarines will know better books on submarine development. Korean war buffs will find the definitive history and fuller microhistories elsewhere. Enthusiasts of naval aviation will have read more complete histories of aircraft carriers. Aficionados of strategy and its cousins, doctrine and tactics, will sate themselves on more specialized accounts. So what does this book propose to do, and what was my reason for writing it? This is a work of synthesis, an interweaving of politics and war, of operations and presidential and command decision, of culture and politics, time and place, threat and perceptions of threat, the exigencies of survival, and the consequences of victory and defeat. The Navy is its focus because the geopolitics of the U.S. has been driven by maritime realities more than by any other single force. Naval operations, since the age of sail, have been global in scope. Today, the fleet is the first thought of U.S. presidents confronted with an international emergency. Whenever a crisis flashes, the first question asked is, where are the aircraft carriers? But the Navy's role encompasses more than naval aviation. Since World War II, surface ships and submarines have all been tools for projecting American power and presence, influencing events worldwide. Though landsmen speak of the world's seven seas, there is in fact only one global ocean. So the experts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declare. The modern U.S. Navy has never needed this reminder, certainly not in the nuclear age. Its contest for command of the world's maritime commons against the only planetary rival it has ever faced, the Soviet Union, illustrates the singularity of the ocean as both an avenue of influence and an actual or potential field of battle. It has often been said that America has never been invaded by a foreign power thanks to its blessings of geography. But oceans are defensive barriers only to the extent that a nation's fleet can master them. Just as surely through history, oceans have been avenues of conquest. The message was clear during the American Revolution and remains equally so today. U.S. fleets, usually operating far from home, have undertaken the defense of America since the U.S. Navy's establishment on October 13, 1775. The story of the Cold War at sea is the story of the contest to secure the freedom of the world. During this time, the U.S. Navy carried, for the first time, a transoceanic mandate evidenced by its permanent deployment from forward overseas stations. In some areas of the world, U.S. fleets were based exclusively at sea, free entirely from dependence upon land. The state of affairs would have been alien and unimaginable to the Navy of America's founding, when naval officers and their men served only during time of conflict, returning to their farms and estates during peacetime. The aim of this book is to develop the story of this global institution as a protector of the national interest. It is a story of geopolitics in theory and practice. Beyond the intrigue of the U.S.-Soviet rivalry are stories of confrontation between fleets, bare-knuckled human strife over strategic concepts and war policy, and technological revolution and disruption, all of it the stuff of a sprawling worldwide drama. This book continues the story concluded in the last of my four books on World War II, The Fleet at Flood Tide, which covered the conclusion and aftermath of World War II in the Pacific. But the story actually reaches all the way back to the American Revolution. Just as the ideas of Sir Julian Corbett begat Nelson at Trafalgar, and the ideas of Alfred Thayer Mahan.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?